This is David Spence for EnergyTradeOffs.com. I'm here today with James Coleman. James is Associate Professor of Law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University and is here today to talk to us about a new article of his that's in a draft form, but is going to be out soon, called State Energy Cartels. James, thanks for sitting down with us today.
It's great to talk with you.
So this is very topical because in the news recently, there was a piece about the Texas Railroad Commission perhaps restricting production again to deal with the way the bottom has fallen out of the oil price market. So this article deals with issues that are both historical but then topical again. And so why don't we start by having you talk a little bit about the portions of the article up front that deal with the history of state energy cartels in the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, so one of the counterintuitive things that this article sort of talks about, both historically and that it's now arising again, a counterintuitive incentive is that although everybody understands that if you're an individual oil company, you don't want to cut back your production because cutting back production means you sell less, means you have less cash flow. But if you controlled every oil company in the world, of course, as a monopoly with market power, you would want to cut back production because cutting back production would raise prices so much that your cash flow would actually increase even though you sold a little bit less. When the U.S. produced 60 or 70% of world crude between the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, it deliberately restrained its production to ensure higher prices for producers. And all oil and gas producers in the United States made more money. And, you know, of course, individual producers would love to cheat on that and receive that higher oil and gas prices that were going in the market. But the states required them to stand by those limits. Of course, here in Texas, that's the Texas Railroad Commission, probably, you know, the most famously misnamed regulator in history, which regulates oil and gas here. But it was actually done on an interstate basis through the Interstate Oil Compact Commission, which is now called the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission, which was created during the New Deal to coordinate these states that all wanted to restrain their production. So there was a nationwide effort to restrain production. Now that all went away in the 60s and 70s, finally ended in 1972, because the center of oil production shifted to the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, which now at that point dominated oil production and still does to a certain extent today. So at that time, OPEC was almost half of world production. Now it's down to about 30%. But they had an interest in restraining oil and gas production to get a higher price. And that's quite common if you control 30 to 50% of the market to want to control production. Now, what is interesting and that's happening now is that the U.S. has moved from being an energy importer that always wanted low prices to an energy exporter again, who at least some places, and certainly here in Texas, has an interest in high oil and gas prices. And that is a trend of the U.S. being an energy exporter that's only projected to increase in future years. So the U.S. will soon projected to be the world's biggest liquefied natural gas exporter and is projected to be a net oil exporter in a few years as well. And so at that point, its interest will coincide more with those countries like Saudi Arabia, like Russia, like the rest of OPEC that have an interest in high oil prices and therefore, as a result, might want to limit production a little bit to ensure high prices for their producers.
There's a particularly colorful history of the historical efforts to restrict production in Texas and also elsewhere that you mentioned and you recount a little bit of in the article. There's also an interesting set of legal questions associated with the reasons, the legally legitimate reasons, why these state commissions might be allowed to restrict production. And there's at least a potential distinction there between restricting production to prevent physical waste of the resource versus restricting production to prop up prices. Can you talk a little bit about the way the law treats that sort of issue?
Yeah, that's really important to understand. So pretty much every oil well in the U.S. has what's called an allowable limit. And allowable means how much oil or gas you're allowed to produce in a certain day. And those allowable limits, you know, they really were first used extensively in the 30s, and they were used for two reasons. One was basically you had to have some limit on production because often you're producing oil and gas from a shared reservoir with your neighbors. And if you pump too fast, you can damage that reservoir, which will limit how much oil you'll ultimately able to produce. So you're able to produce more over the long term if you pump more gradually. So there's that one reason, which is to protect the oil reservoir and everybody else that's pumping from it. The second reason that you set those limits and that they're actually ratcheted further down is because if you are a state, as we said, the U.S. was in the middle of the 20th century, and the Railroad Commission was until 1972, that benefits from higher oil and gas prices, you want to restrain production a little bit further to maximize your recovery. There's a lot of economic theory on this question, specifically about how quickly you would like to produce. You know, if you controlled all global oil supply, you might keep prices a little bit higher. As a state regulator, you have to at least think a little bit about your consumers in your state as well, and they probably want affordable oil and gas. But to some extent, as you sort of optimize that question of production, you're trying to keep prices high to benefit these industries that your state benefits from. Now, the interesting thing is, as I said, as the U.S. became a major net oil importer, had a strong interest in oil prices, in low oil prices, and as global oil production shifted to be dominated by the Middle East, the U.S. dropped that reason for allowable limits. So they basically said, you know what, we're not concerned with maintaining high prices anymore, so we're going to keep the allowables, but just to protect the oil reservoir. And still, any conventional well that you have around the U.S. has an allowable limit that's to protect the oil, the shared oil reservoir. Now, the interesting thing is, even that reason for allowable limits has gone away in the last 10 years with a focus on fracking, because when you fracture a shale formation to get your oil and gas, you are creating your own reservoir. So you're only getting oil and gas, hopefully, from basically, to a first approximation, from something that you fractured yourself. So there's no reason to slow down production to protect that common reservoir. So it's still the case that all these oil wells have allowable limits, but they're typically set, because they're on fractured wells, higher than you're ever going to ever be binding. And so as a result, just in the last 10 years, these allowable limits, although they're still used in theory, have gone into disuse in practice. And I think, you know, because of that, people have started to forget, well, wait a second, yes, one reason was to protect the common reservoir. But when you're an energy exporter, there's a second reason, which is that you want to keep oil and gas prices. And that second reason, I think, is potentially what state regulators are currently looking at recovering.
And you suggest that now that the United States is becoming a major exporter of both oil and the natural gas that is often produced with oil, that it might make sense for the old International Oil and Gas Commission, or sorry, the U.S. National Oil and Gas Commission, to do that work that the Railroad Commission and commissions like it do at the state level, both to sort of try to have an effect on the prices of the commodities in those two markets. But you also suggest that there might be a side benefit to the limiting flaring at the wellhead as a result of those sorts of efforts. Could you sort of unpack that argument and explain it a little bit?
You know, there's never going to be the same kind of limits that the U.S. had in the 60s or in the 40s and 50s, when the U.S. was 70% of global oil production. Because, you know, it only makes sense to cut back production to increase prices if you have market power. If you control enough of the market that you can raise prices enough that you benefit more from the high prices than you lose from selling a little bit less. And the U.S. is never going to recover that kind of power in global markets, right? It might if it formed an alliance with OPEC, Saudi Arabia, Russia, but let's assume that that's unlikely for the time being. what could they do in the meantime? Well, there are times when the regulator does have market power, or the combination of companies or cartel that the regulator regulates has market power within limited markets, because there are transport constraints that can make those markets have very different pricing than global markets. So to give you an example, in the province of Alberta, in late 2018, they were, because they have transport constraints, they don't have enough pipelines to get all their oil to market. They had all those barrels of oil chasing a limited amount of pipeline capacity. And that was bidding oil prices in Alberta down to $14 a barrel, when oil was selling for $55, heavy oil on the Gulf Coast for $55 a barrel. And so the province of Alberta, eventually the oil and gas companies came to the province of Alberta and said, you have to stop wasting this resource, selling it for $14 when we know it's worth $60 at the Gulf Coast, you have to slow down production. And so Alberta quite quickly imposed a 9% production cut. And the immediate reaction of the markets was that oil prices in Alberta went from trading at $14 a barrel to $42 a barrel. So basically you had oil prices tripling while only a reduction in production of 9%, which massively increased cash flow for those Canadian companies. Now, you know, it's a truism that oil markets are global, and so no one province can affect them. But this Alberta example shows that when you have transport constraints, you can actually have a big impact. The regulator may have market power within that market of addressing what are sometimes transient, but sometimes longer transport constraints. So the question would be, where does that kind of transport constraint exist in the United States? And there are small differentials with respect to oil pricing. In the Bakken, it's a little bit lower priced. In West Texas, at times, it's a little bit lower priced. But the biggest transport constraints are not in the oil markets, they're in the natural gas markets, because natural gas is more expensive to transport, and because you can't transport it, at least currently, by rail or truck. You basically have to send it by a pipeline. You've only got one option, and those take a while to build. So, you know, what's happening currently, we have low natural gas prices around the United States. Natural gas is typically measured by the Henry Hub price in Louisiana. When people talk about a natural gas price, that's what they mean. But there's very different prices in different places. Prices can be very high in California, in Boston, in New York. But they are very low in places that has a lot of fracking. And part of the reason for that is many of these fracked wells, most of them produce a mix of hydrocarbons. And so there are oil producers that are producing wells because they want to sell the oil, but it comes with a lot of natural gas. And so that natural gas is flooding markets that don't yet have enough pipelines to get it to markets where people will pay for it. And the result of that has been two things. One is that there has been actually negative pricing often in some overserved markets. This is true in Alberta in Canada. It's also true in West Texas. It's also true at times in North Dakota. But the second result is if natural gas prices are negative, the first thing that an oil and gas company would try to do, it's not going to want to pay somebody to get rid of it. It's cheap to just light a match and burn off that natural gas. You burn it so that it's not vented to the atmosphere as methane, which is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So, you know, we ask them to burn it rather than vent it. But that flaring is now approaching, you know, really crisis levels in Texas and North Dakota. And what I mean by that is that, you know, Texas and North Dakota are now flaring so much natural gas because it's worth zero or less. They're flaring so much natural gas in both those locations that it's more than some states use. In fact, more than some significant countries use. So it's just a staggering quantity of natural gas. And what that suggests is that there may be market power in those markets, right? Those are markets where transport is constrained. And it's possible that if the regulator were to cut back production, you would see natural gas prices recover above zero. And once natural gas prices are above zero, there's a lot of incentive to sell it to a market.
Don't the rules already require them not to indefinitely flare?
Yes, they do. And so they have to keep coming back for more flaring permits. And for the most part, both in Texas and North Dakota, the two places where we have the biggest flaring problem, the regulators have pretty much let them do that. I can tell you that North Dakota, its industrial commission, which regulates this, has started to make noises that maybe they're going to start imposing their flaring limits and, in fact, you know, crack down on it. In Texas, you had a very rare dissent from a flaring permit that happened at the end of last year. And so there is some possibility that they will start to crack down on flaring permits. That's one of the issues that's going to be sort of on the ballot in the November election. I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the amount of flaring that's happening in West Texas. And you saw that the commissioner that was Ryan Sitton, who was running for, he lost his primary and he's got some strong challengers in the Democratic field. So that could be an interesting, election, but nobody's come up with any solutions. And I should say, even, you know, so no flaring permit has been denied. The only one that there was even a dissent on was a really extraordinary case where the pipeline was already hooked up, where a well was already hooked up to a pipeline and it still got a flaring permit. You might ask, like, why would you get a flaring permit if you're hooked up to a pipeline? And the pipeline company has sued the Railroad Commission saying that it's wrong. Now, let me tell you, you know, there's a reason, which is you got negative prices. So the pipeline company, what they don't say, they say, oh, well, we're already connected to them. They shouldn't be flaring. What they don't say is they're going to have to pay us for gas. And so, of course, they would love that. I think it's important to understand it's not just happening at the wells. There's a recent study that showed there's a huge amount of flaring that happens at processing plants as well, which basically any time that natural gas is a waste product with negative prices, basically that suggests it's a waste product that's harmful to society, people will try to find ways to get rid of it. And, you know, that means flaring it. It happens all over the system wherever there's negative prices. But it also, you know, unfortunately, there's lots of leaks in our system. And those, you know, that's regulated. The you're supposed to limit those leaks and vents. But the problem is, you know, if the incentive is not to find leaks because the leaks are saving you money because it's less of a waste product that you have to dispose of otherwise, you know, you're going to have a hard time with the regulators chasing down all those leaks, particularly since that hurts their own industry, the industry that, you know, they may care about its financial well-being. And so, you know, it's a much better situation if you have positive prices and then everybody, including the industry, has an incentive to capture that gas and sell it. If you can reduce the flaring of natural gas, that's great, not only because you're reducing the carbon emissions there, but if you can get natural gas to markets, if natural gas, it can, you know, not only does it reduce carbon emissions if it's replacing coal or fuel oil, but it has a, or heating oil, it has a massive benefit in terms of air quality, in terms of, I mean, basically it takes particulate matter emissions or sulfur dioxide almost to zero compared to those other fossil fuels. So that's great. So that's, you know, those are benefits, but, you know, if you want to talk about real international cooperation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, if there was a global oil deal between Russia, OPEC, and the United States. So if you're talking about oil has different meanings, but based on, you know, one meaning of oil, which includes some of the natural gas liquids, the world consumes about 100 million barrels a day. OPEC is about 30% of that, Russia is about 12% of that, and the U.S. is about 18% of that. So if you take OPEC's 30 plus Russia's 12 plus the U.S.'s 18, that's 60% of global oil markets. They absolutely have oil market power. If they could coordinate, their producers would all benefit with higher oil and gas prices, and that would have slowing oil and gas production would, of course, have would mean massive reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. So it's kind of an interesting and counterintuitive case where and probably a rare case, a rare opportunity to potentially be seized where the major fossil fuel exporting countries actually have an interest in doing something that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Let me ask, what effect, if any, does the prediction that worldwide oil and gas demand, or oil demand anyway, will decline over time have on your analysis? Or does it depend on how fast that happens?
Okay, well, there's two things. One is there's a decline right now, the biggest decline the world has ever seen, right? Because it is it's just been so rapid because of the coronavirus. And that is a unique scenario. That's exactly the scenario that in the Depression led to the development of these tools, which was that basically there was new production coming online into a depressed global economy. And so people said, wait a second, we can't just dump all this oil at bargain basement prices. It was at time selling for 2 cents a barrel. We need to raise that. The rallying cry at the time was dollar oil. So they wanted a dollar a barrel, which, you know, 50 times greater, big difference. But your question isn't about that short-term contraction. It's about the long-term contraction, which is to say, if we see a move towards electric vehicles, if we see a move that leads to gradual decline in oil production, how does that affect the analysis? The basic answer is that it limits the upside from coordination. I mean, if you thought that in 5 years nobody was going to be using oil anymore, you would dump it all on the market, right? But that would happen regardless of whether you were coordinating or not, right? So the benefits of coordination, become bigger to the extent that you think there's still going to be some oil used in future years. You know, all I can tell you on that is OPEC is begging for a deal. They don't think that they should dump all their oil on global markets right now. Their view is oil will continue to have value in coming decades. I should also say, even if you thought oil was going away very soon, it's not that there would be no coordination. There would just be smaller benefits to it, because you still might, as monopoly producers, say, well, let's at least get high prices while we can. You might say, you know, let's get high prices for what we have. Let's not drill so much because that won't be as necessary. So that, you know, the global oil markets are already taking into account, and global oil producers, that they are already making their own predictions about what's going to happen in global oil demand. It's just the case that if they were coordinating production decisions, they would significantly cut back.
Well, thanks for sitting down with us, James.
Absolutely.